In today's episode, we're going to talk about the menopause belly, what causes it, and how do you get rid of it. I'm Dr. Valerie with Progress Your Health.
And I'm Dr. Mackey from Progress Your Health. Now, if there is one symptom or one issue in menopause that, you know, is top of the list pretty much across the board, it would have to be the menopausal weight gain. I mean, would you agree?
Yeah, I definitely would say the majority of women that we work with menopause, weight gain's at the top.
Yeah. Now, it could be temporarily, could be hot flashes, night sweats, maybe not sleeping very well, maybe some mood issues, but still in those top, one, two or three spots, it's going to be, the unexplained or the unearned, as you say, sometimes the unearned weight gain that it's almost like inevitable. You hit a certain point and all of a sudden now you're going to gain, 5, 10, 15, 20, 25 pounds. So why don't we kind of dive into it? So what do you think is happening there in menopause, and why do women, even though their lifestyles really haven't changed probably in a decade or more, why do they just spontaneously start gaining weight?
You know, to be honest, it really starts in perimenopause, and then it really further exacerbates into menopause. So if you were really to look at it historically and if, a female's life is, you're looking at perimenopause first and then menopause. So I would say menopause, of course, it's a drop in estrogen, menopause is classic drop in estrogen. Now in perimenopause, your estrogen doesn't necessarily drop, but your progesterone does. So that's kind of what starts the cascade of this hormonal change, which creates this weight gain. Because a lot of women will say it's not about that they're gaining weight all over. You know, that can happen a little, but it's really more around the middle.
Yeah, yeah, of course. The spare tire, the muffin top, whatever they...
love handles.
Yeah, whatever they want to describe.
Jelly belly.
Yeah, however they want to describe it. I've heard so many of them over the years say, I've always had a flat stomach. I've never had any stomach issues. And now I just have this midsection that I just can't get rid of. So physiologically, and I agree with you, it's sort of like a rhetorical question that I asked you, but certainly early 40s or early to mid 40s, mid to later 40s and then into the 50s, I would agree that it, the whole process starts in perimenopause. So what's going on there physiologically?
Well, you mean like with the estrogen or it's really about the insulin, right? I would say, there's so many other hormones. There's the cortisol, there's the insulin, there's the GABA, there's the neurohormones. There's so many things going on there. I will say one other aspect to it, because I'm going to go off on a tangent here. I know you're asking me about this, but it's not just about the weight gain. It's about the inability to lose the weight.
Sure.
Because when you're in your 20s and 30s, you can just exercise a little bit more, cut out some foods or skip a meal. And it's like, geez, you could even hold your breath and then you lose 5 pounds. Mm-hmm. But it totally changes once you hit perimenopause and menopause. So I think that's probably one of the biggest frustrations is they're gaining the weight, not necessarily changing their lifestyle, but they can't lose it. Even if they do, like I've had patients, and I'm sure you have too, in menopause where they'll say, I cut my calories to nothing, which don't do that because that doesn't work in weight loss, but or long-term weight loss. But they'll say, I cut my calories to nothing because they felt like they couldn't do anything and still lost like 1 pound. So it's really not about calories in, calories out. There's some aspects to that, but it's really about the hormones, right?
Yeah. Now, certainly with the GLP-1 medications, certainly that, that's sort of front and center. I mean, I think it has made some of that menopausal weight gain or perimenopausal weight gain a lot easier. You just said, let's not restrict calories too much. And those medications are basically our caloric restriction medications.
Technically, some of them do work on, I think the tirzepatide works a little bit more on the ghrelin in your stomach, so it can make you not feel hungry. Mm-hmm. It also works, I think, the GP or the GIP part of it will work on the hypothalamus so that it, changes your satiation. It slows down transit time, of course, to make you feel full. So there are some aspects, but I think for the right person, the GLP would be really good. Now we're going to kind of dive into that a little bit, what are we looking at when you're looking at menopausal weight gain? Sure, I want to fit into my pants. I'm in menopause.
Sure.
I want to fit into my pants. But there's other aspects when you're looking at menopausal weight gain which are destructive. You're looking at, like I've said to you before, I feel like the biggest risk factor for chronic disease in women, heart disease, diabetes, inflammation, Alzheimer's, is menopause. That is the biggest risk factor, because when those hormones drop, it creates a whole cascade of inflammation that can further increase your risk for all those, what they call age-related, I would call them more hormone-related, but chronic diseases, where we're talking a little bit about fitting into your pants versus, you know, I don't want to get diabetes.
Sure. Or cancer or Alzheimer's or any of those, you know, age-related problems that, you're right, women are sort of at a definite disadvantage because inevitably those hormones are going to disappear. So automatically, without even trying anything, your estrogen drops, your insulin, maybe insulin doesn't go up necessarily, but your insulin sensitivity goes down. Mm-hmm. Right? So you become automatically more insulin resistant. You and I have been talking about insulin for years. Now it's starting to, seems like in the last, what would you say, the last 5 years or so, maybe in the last 2 to 3, that the insulin topic is really getting discussed on a regular basis.
Oh, absolutely. And for those of you that might be new, we talk about insulin all the time. In fact, I just wrote an article for our newsletter about, you know, insulin resistance and menopausal weight gain and perimenopausal weight gain.
And that's why we're doing this episode, because it was a nice piggyback.
So interesting,
on which,
yes.
Yeah. And there's a lot to unpack there. There's a lot going on, you know, physiologically, what a woman's body is experiencing and why those things, not only is it the weight gain in the short term, but like you said, there's some long-term, you know, potential risk factors there.
Yeah. So like, so for example, not to be too boring, insulin is released from your pancreas in response to glucose, blood sugar going up in your body. So I eat a cookie, my blood sugar goes up, my insulin is secreted by the pancreas. Insulin unlocks the door on the cell to allow that glucose to go into the cell and provide as fuel. Now, when you have too much insulin, because insulin is a fat-storing hormone, it's really easy to gain, and it's really hard to lose. And what you'll find in perimenopause is you'll see a little bit of that propagation of insulin resistance that's you're more vulnerable to it than you are when you're in your 20s. But, you know, you can see a little bit of that propagation of that insulin resistance or that vulnerability. But then once you hit menopause and that estrogen drops, that's really when you're at so much of a, like you could say, like I have patients that say, you know, I haven't changed my diet. I mean, I don't eat bad. I mean, I hope people have birthday parties and cookies or celebrations. They're like, I don't eat bad. But once you hit menopause and that estrogen drops, it's really easy to have that insulin start to go up. And once it starts going up, it's really hard to bring it back down.
Yeah, it's almost like the way I describe it sometimes, it's almost like a snowball, you know, going downhill. Like that insulin problem it gains momentum. The more insulin you produce, which then tells your body to produce more insulin, and it starts to compound on itself. So from what you just said, and you know, again, just trying to hash it out here. So the estrogen basically is, it keeps the insulin at bay. It keeps the body more responsive to insulin, so then your body doesn't keep creating more of it. Now here's where the problem really doubles down. When your body starts producing too much insulin, now it's going to tell your body to store more fat. But then the bad part, what you alluded to when we first started talking, is that the presence of higher insulin now inhibits your body's ability to burn the fat, right? So now you can't, you know, you just can't get it to budge no matter what. So that insulin level has to drop in order for your body to be able to mobilize stored body fat. And, you know, that can be really frustrating. That can be really challenging for, you know, people to push through that, you know, that metabolic barrier in order to get the weight to come off.
Yeah. And you know, because it's all interconnected. So estrogen helps the insulin sensitivity on the cell. So if the cell is sensitive to insulin, you don't need much insulin to open up that door and let that glucose go in. Now, the other caveat that comes with low estrogen is when that estrogen drops, the cortisol tends to go up, or you can't buffer the cortisol. And what does cortisol do? I mean, we need cortisol. Cortisol comes from your adrenal glands. We need it to survive. But cortisol helps me get from meal to meal. So if I ate breakfast this morning at 6:30, and then maybe I'll forget to eat lunch just because life got busy, and then I might get something later in the afternoon, that's okay. But so I don't pass out and die at 11:30 or noon, my cortisol is released and then it mobilizes.
Pass out and die at 11:30 from that eating?
Because the blood sugar dropped. My cortisol will mobilize some of the glycogen stores. Oh,
we're designed to go 3 days without food, not 3 or 4 hours without
food. But it helps keep that blood sugar balanced, you know, meal to meal, so it doesn't drop too much. So when that cortisol pulls the glycogen or the stored sugar out, it can keep my blood sugar level. Now, let's say I've already eaten. That's fine. But my estrogen's down because I'm in menopause. Mm-hmm. And that cortisol, or I get a stressor like a nasty email or...
A fight with your husband.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Is then that cortisol goes up. It mobilizes some of that glucose, and then the pancreas says, oh, look, there's some glucose in your body. What are we going to do? We're going to secrete some insulin, and then you end up storing that in the middle.
And you store it right around the midsection.
That is like non-caloric weight gain, a way to gain weight just by being stressed.
Yeah, without eating. Now, there's a very small segment of the population that when they get stressed, their weight actually goes down, right? That's a very small percentage. The majority of us, we get some kind of stressor and our weight goes up. It's like you didn't earn it. Like there was no food intake there. You didn't enjoy the process. You just gained weight without even trying. So then again, just to, sort of recap that. So it's almost like a two-pronged problem then for a menopausal woman. As her estrogen goes down, now they're more responsive, so to speak, to the insulin and to the cortisol. And then it just sort of, hormonally every single day. We talk to a lot of women that are busy, taking care of their kids, working full time. They don't sleep that well. All those things are going to raise your cortisol levels, which then sort of indirectly sort of raises your insulin levels, which then can sort of have an impact on your behavior, maybe what you're consuming or what you're not consuming. And then it just, again, that snowball just sort of, starts to gain momentum and roars downhill really fast.
And it really starts in perimenopause, like I was saying. So in perimenopause, the progesterone drops, which you'll notice women, because progesterone also helps keep cortisol down, especially at night to help us sleep at night. So you'll see in perimenopause that progesterone drops, you're not sleeping as well, that cortisol's elevated, and that's when they start to notice, my pants are tight, or I'm just, put on like 6 pounds for no reason. Yeah. So, but usually in perimenopause, and this is kind of that distinction why it's nice to catch it then, is, the health is still pretty good. You take a perimenopausal woman, she's still healthy, her blood work looks really good, she's maybe gained a few pounds, her pants are a little tight, but it's all vanity pounds because she's relatively healthy. It's that snowball effect you see of that insulin starting to creep up, that cortisol's creeping up, and then you hit menopause, that estrogen drops. That's when you start to see more of those risk factors happen. Where somebody in perimenopause has relatively good blood work, then you check a woman in menopause and they're like, why is my hemoglobin A1C elevated? Why is my CRP elevated? Why does it feel like what a lot of menopausal women will say? They'll say, I look pregnant, because it's not that they have that superficial, little jelly roll that, a lot of us have, that's okay. It's more like it's hard or it's on the inside, and that's a different kind of fat than just a superficial roll. That's that visceral fat, which that creates the danger zone.
Yeah, so subcutaneous is the stuff on the surface, like right below the surface of the skin, stuff that we don't really want necessarily, or we want less thereof, right? But the visceral fat, like you said, you could still be relatively thin, and I heard something about Asian women, particularly, just because you're Asian, that they can be, thin body structure, but actually have, during menopause, they can actually have an increase in visceral fat formation, which the visceral fat, now that is metabolically active. It can create all these inflammatory, compounds, which then increases all those things we've already talked about. And again, that whole snowball effect just continues to happen.
Yeah, so visceral fat, it means just that it's adipose tissue or fat tissue around the viscera of your organs. That's different.
And sometimes it even deposits inside your organs, mm-hmm. like your liver.
Yeah, like a fatty liver.
Yeah.
So that's inside like the, what do you call those abs?
Yeah. Inside our abs. Your peritoneum, the abdominal cavity. So you got a whole bunch in your guts there. You got a whole bunch of things all packed up in the, squished in there. There's not a lot of space, but when you have visceral fat accumulation, it'll start to form around those internal organs. And that's when the risk of all those things you were talking about earlier, that's when the risk of those things really starts to ramp up. So that's why menopausal women are, if you didn't do anything and you just hit menopause, you're increasing your risk for all those age-related problems.
Yeah, exactly.
By doing nothing, just by going into menopause. Yeah,
just because that estrogen dropped.
Right.
First, the progesterone and perimenopause to kind of start that cascade of cortisol and insulin starting to creep up. And progesterone itself, actually, when you gain weight, progesterone will direct it to more superficial tissue. So progesterone is actually really nice to help sort of shuttle, if you're going to gain weight, more into the superficial tissue rather than the viscera. But when that progesterone goes down, then that's kind of starting, it's like planting the seed. Then you go into menopause and then estrogen drops, and that's where that visceral fat, that's where you get the inflammation, you know, that's where you get risk for, like I was saying, heart disease, diabetes, and, inflammatory conditions.
And we're talking about hormones, so cancer plays a role in that. You know, cancer is not so much of a, you know, there's kind of a new idea about cancer that it's not so much of a genetic issue as opposed to being what we're talking about is a metabolic issue. So as you become more insulin resistant and all those things, it's potentially increasing your risk for developing, in this context, you know, developing breast cancer.
Yeah.
Which I think I saw some statistics, you know, we've mentioned it before, like 13% of women in America are going to develop breast cancer. Now, don't quote me on that, know those exact numbers, and if that's in their lifetime, I believe it was in their lifetime, like 1 out of 8 women is going to, no matter what they do, no matter how well they take care of themselves, 13%, 1 out of 8 women is going to develop breast cancer. How does a woman keep their weight in check, but at the same time prevent cancer? I think those two things are one and the same in some respects.
Yeah, like we'd, like I'd mentioned earlier, don't go on a diet and restrict your calories, because that's just going to, you know, set your body, you know, set you up for failure, because you might lose initially, but then it's going to come back. It's really about, like we talked about earlier, and we talk about all the time, it's really about working on those insulin levels.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
You love to talk about insulin. So how, let's say before we, you know, of course there's HRT, hormone replacement. I've always talked about static dosing and rhythmic dosing and different ways to use hormone replacement to help with insulin mm-hmm. resistance and menopause and reducing chronic risk factors. But what would you say in terms of just like lifestyle? Let's say someone's like, what can I do right this second?
Yeah, I mean, that's the, you know, that's the sort of the million-dollar question. Like, what can we do to sort of offset all that before we even get to prescriptions and hormones and all those things? I mean, we don't want to repeat ourselves over and over and over, but I do think that a glycemically friendly diet has to be number one. Right? So not too hard on the, not too heavy on the carbohydrates. Most carbohydrates should be more fiber-based than calorie-based. You know, or the level of, you know, what we used to describe them as, you know, how starchy a carbohydrate is, less on the starchy, you know, more on the fiber type vegetables, depending on your activity level, right? If you're going to the gym on a regular basis, for everyone that does work out consistently, carbohydrates are very good for activity. Mm-hmm. They help your muscles. They help you perform better. You're stronger. You can recover better. You know, so a low carb diet per se isn't always the best approach. But if you're not that active, then you would want to, you know, sort of scale back on some of those starchier carbohydrates, because your body just doesn't. It doesn't over time. It you know, just based on what we've been talking about with menopause, your body over time is gonna tolerate them less the older you get.
And I will say, even me, I mean, carbohydrates can taste really good.
Of course,
I mean,
yeah.
Carbohydrates taste good. And when your insulin's elevated, they taste really good, because that insulin is almost like pushing you like a drug to go eat those refined carbohydrates. That we were talking about this the other day, about increasing up your protein, where if you increase up your protein so much, it's like, oh, so much protein. but then you're like not hungry. And I'll be the first to say, I don't hit my probably
Protein macros.
My protein goals, I probably should. It's just like, it's so much protein I'm eating all day. That's just so much food. But you do that, it really does suppress that appetite for those refined carbohydrates.
But the minute you have the refined carbohydrates, then you just want more of them. You know, our reward centers in our brain is definitely very much a feed-forward mechanism. The more you have, the more you want.
No pun intended.
Oh, what do you mean?
Feed-forward. Feed.
Well, that's what I'm saying. That's why I said it's a feed forward mechanism, meaning that the more you have, the more you eat, the more you want to eat, when it just keeps going and going and going. That's why people, you know, sometimes, you know, then you become leptin. Everyone hears about leptin. Someone like you is not leptin resistant. Even someone like me is not leptin resistant. But once you get to a certain point, and that's sort of an arbitrary, you know, it's not really about the weight. It's more about your body's response. Leptin basically shuts off your appetite when your fat stores are at a satisfied place. But if you keep going on that, you know, carbohydrate hamster wheel, then your own mechanisms that tell you that you're full basically get distorted. And now we can't, literally, we cannot stop eating those types of foods in the first place.
Yeah, and the dopamine too, right? The dopamine reinforcement pathway?
Yeah, yeah. Dopamine, leptin, insulin, there's a whole bunch of things happening between your fat cells, your brain, your gut, your pancreas. All these things are communicating. And normally, if we're eating a glycemically friendly diet, our body is going to be able to, all those touch points, all those feedback loops and everything are going to be able to regulate themselves, and your weight should stay relatively stable. Okay. But once we start getting into the processed food world, now granted, this is not a new thing. Everyone sort of knows. This is where also, from what we're talking about, this feed forward mechanism in the brain, this is where I think that the GLP-1 medications can actually provide a great deal of benefit, because it just turns off that little bit of desire in the brain. So now you can, now what I would recommend, we were talking about lifestyle. So the two things. What we consume, actually maybe three things: what we consume, how we move our body, how, when, and how often we move our body, and how well we sleep at night. Mm-hmm. Okay, I think those are the three things that people sort of need to pay attention to as a sort of a foundational thing. Because if you're not sleeping well, you're going to gain weight, or if you're not sleeping well, you're at least not going to be able to lose the weight. Mm-hmm. If your diet is too heavy in carbohydrates, and usually you can sort of, this is no, not, you know, shaming anybody, but usually the size of someone's body determines how well they're able to tolerate carbohydrates. Like you, you're thin, you can tolerate carbohydrates pretty well, where someone that is, a little bit heavier in size and has a little different body shape, their tolerance to carbohydrates is not as great, right? So they should eat less of them.
Because we're all individuals and we all have different genetic backgrounds. Some, I have some patients' blood work, they're terrible eaters, but their blood work, like their cholesterol is phenomenal. It's better than mine. And, you have all these factors because we're all human. We're all unique. You said something really interesting about the exercise, because muscle mass, like muscle is like a sink for glucose because it loves to grab glucose and pull it out of the bloodstream. It's one really nice way to set up your insulin sensitivity, but also help bring down that glucose.
Yeah, and honestly, muscle, when we could just talk on and on and on about insulin and muscle, because we say it all the time. The number one factor for aging is what they call sarcopenia. You lose your muscle, you age more rapidly. Literally, now you have to, be concerned about metabolic rate and frailty and all these things that happen once women are in menopause. That's a counter argument to the GLP-1s. It control appetite, so you can sort of get control of your food intake and your choices. But now at the same time, you can potentially set yourself up for losing muscle mass. Yeah. And that is, sort of a recipe for disaster, because if a woman's in her 40s and 50s or beyond, good luck trying to get that muscle back. I mean, literally, and once you lose that muscle, and I think I saw something this morning, I was looking up some information, that you lose 3-8% of muscle, I think it was per decade after the age of 30. So your muscle peaks out, I think your bone and muscle peaks out in your 20s, and then from your 30s on, you're losing, roughly 10% a year. If you round it up, I mean, that's without even doing anything, right? So we have to stay physically viable in order for, again, this menopausal weight gain issue. And I've noticed even with both of our patients, the ones that are metabolically healthy are the ones that don't gain any weight and when they hit menopause, like yourself. You're metabolically healthy, your weight has not changed, maybe a couple of pounds here or there. But the ones that are insulin resistant going into perimenopause or menopause, it's sort of menopause sort of exacerbates that whole situation. And I think I heard some crazy statistic, like 90% of Americans are in some level of insulin resistance. Oh, yeah. Like it's a crazy high number. And that most, medical doctors, most conventional PCPs, whatever, they're just not really paying any attention to it.
Because they're looking at the glucose, right? So, because you can have somebody that insulin is very high, but their glucose is still in perfect range.
Yeah,
and that's
absolutely
because the pancreas is having to pump out so much insulin to keep the glucose in range.
Yeah.
But because all that insulin, eventually you're just going to gain more weight and more weight, more inflammation, and then that it can't hold that glucose back. Yeah. And that's where that diabetes type 2, which I do feel like the GLP-1 agonist injections are probably really good for that woman in her mid-50s. She's got high hemoglobin A1C. She's pretty much diabetic, if you know, pre-diabetic, if not like pretty much right there. High insulin, borderline blood sugar that's going to go
blood,
up.
High blood pressure, high blood triglycerides.
Yeah. High triglycerides, that visceral fat where it just looks like they say, like I lost my waistline, I look pregnant, everything's hard.
Your waist to hip ratio, yeah. Right? So that midsection, as the midsection grows, your waist is going to be bigger than your hips. If that, I don't know what the exact numbers are, or what the ratio is, but if your waist is bigger than your hips, then the risk for all those age-related mm-hmm. problems go up significantly.
Because sometimes it's really hard at that point to get started to reverse that. Because like you said, it's hard to reverse things like
that.
It takes
a lot of work.
You have to do, but I do feel like those GLPs would be good for that individual, but at the same time, they've got to build the muscle. The muscle to yep. grab the glucose. They've got, you know, they've got to change the dietary.
If you're using a GLP, I think the goal there is, and I think a lot of smart clinics and smart doctors are encouraging their patients that you have to be doing some kind of resistance training to at least preserve the muscle that you have. You cannot be in a caloric deficit. This is, you know, sort of normal bro science, you know, normal bodybuilding science. You cannot build muscle in a caloric deficit, right? It is, you know, kind of against the law of thermodynamics, but you can be in somewhat of a caloric deficit with the GLP-1s, but maintain your muscle and maybe get leaner, which is what we all want. Who cares if the scale moves as long as our body fat percentage is going down? Because at the end of the day, we want to lose fat, not muscle. Mm-hmm. And that's why, you know, DEXA scans or bod pods or anything that looks at your body fat percentage before and after, and your lean muscle mass or your lean body mass, which is basically bones and muscle combined. You know, some of the DEXA scans can kind of separate those out. You want to make sure that it's the weight you're losing is from the body fat and not coming from muscle.
Exactly.
Because that's, you know, once you lose it, you're in your, you know, like right now, you just turned 52. You lose muscle now, you're going to have to work your tail off and completely change your diet, increase all your food, which could encourage more weight gain in order to build muscle back. Okay. Yeah. That's really hard to do. Men know how hard it is to build muscle, right? Because they spend all their time in the gym. And if you're not using TRT or some type of testosterone, it's really challenging to build muscle. It's even harder for women to build muscle because you don't have the testosterone levels that men have. In some ways, women are sort of a little bit of a disadvantage because not only does menopause set them up for failure, not being able to maintain or build muscle also sort of sets them up for failure. So you're kind of screwed in both ways a little bit.
No, I totally agree with you. So the GLPs, I think, are, you know, good for certain individuals. There's other things we could talk about a little bit with low dosing or spreading out the injections. But I will have to say, because we love the hormones, we do have to touch on the hormone replacement.
Of course, yeah.
Doing the hormone replacement, and I get a lot of women that say, oh yeah, give me the hormone replacement. They think they're going to take, you know, estrogen and progesterone and the pounds are going to fall off. It's not exactly that easy. Now that would be awesome if it was.
It would be just as good of a selling drug as the GLP-1s, but it doesn't work quite
but
like that.
But it can set the stage. You know, it can help you sleep better. It can make your insulin sensitivity better. It can help with that mood. It can give you more energy, more motivation. Yeah. So you can set the stage to be able to help, you know, add in the dietary part, add in the exercise part, and then you can really put the whole thing together.
Yeah, they're just sort of tools that can be sort of constructed in a way that, you know, sets you up for success because now you're taking care of some of those, problem areas. But you're right. You know, you're not going to take HRT and you're going to magically lose the weight. Even thyroid medication, a lot of people think you're going to increase thyroid function by taking medication. You're going to drop the weight. That happens, you know, very rarely.
It's in combination. Like, hey, my energy's better, so I'm going to make a different choice. I'm going to ride my bike, or hey, I feel pretty good today. I don't want to eat the garbage. Yeah, I'm going to, you know, do something different. So it's all kind of setting the stage for it, but it all comes together.
One thing I think that the hormones do, let's say in the beginning we're talking to a new patient, at least this is the approach we've taken over the years, is that a lot of times some of those things take a lot of work and effort. And if you're stressed and tired and can't sleep, the last thing you have is the the desire or the ability or the energy to make those adjustments or changes. Where if you got the hormones, now you're sleeping a little bit better, your mood's a little bit better. You know, now all of a sudden, now you can, you know, kind of what you alluded to, now you can start making those adjustments. And within a short period of time, everything sort of changes. And then your weight starts to go down and your energy goes up and your mood improves. And, you know, now it's a completely different situation. It's not so much that the medications, the hormones did it themselves. They allowed behavior change and other things to happen, pattern change. And now there's a very nice response on the back end of that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot more we could talk about there. Where should we go? Where should we go next?
Well, I know everybody's saying, well, I want to lose it. You know, we're talking about how, you know, we're talking about some aspects to that and why it's always in the middle because of that insulin, because that estrogen dropping, because that progesterone, because of the cortisol. And then, you know, then having that insulin go up and then you want to eat more is, I do think kind of to sum it up is you want to, you know, we want to build muscle because that helps with that insulin sensitivity.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Bar none. If you just did that alone,
just that.
That would be because you and I have been talking a lot about, I remember you and I were having a conversation years ago and I've been on this insulin thing since pretty much our entire career. A good follow on social media. He's a PhD from BYU University. His name is Dr. Ben Bickman. All he does in his lab at BYU is study insulin. He's on Instagram, and his content is actually, I've learned a lot from that guy. Now, a lot of things I sort of already knew, but then there's some things that I thought that I knew, you know, or theories that I had. And then over the years, as I've been listening to some of his information, he sort of confirmed some of my thoughts. So it's really nice to see. That's why why doesn't anyone talk about insulin? Like insulin is such a crucial thing now granted, we've realized being in practice for 20 years that insurance care doesn't really focus on what's in the best interest of the patient. Right. That's why doctors like you and I will test insulin and test hormones and things like that. But when you go to your primary care doctor, they're a little bit reticent to do that because
they want to fix what's broken.
Well, there's also control sort of behind the scenes that doesn't do necessarily what's in the patient's best interest. Where that's why every new patient we see, we test a fasting insulin because it's that important. Mm-hmm. You know, that it's one of the most important things on an entire blood panel. If your number is, you know, 17, 22, 25, you got a little bit of a big problem there. If your insulin is under 10, you're doing pretty good. Mm-hmm. You know,
ideally under 7, seven and below.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. 5, you know, ours, when we did ours at, beginning of the year, yours was like 1.2 and
like 2 or
mine
something.
Was like 1.7 or something.
It was good. I was happy about that.
But you know, you and I walk a lot, right? You know, we walk, we lift weights, we, you know, we do all those activity things. We're going to try to sum it up here. So,
the exercise
is number one. So I got off on a, you know, big tangent there. Exercise, I think I wouldn't say it's number one, but I'd say it's one of the top three, the dietary component. But I think that you can get away with a little bit more on the dietary indiscretion if your activity is.
You used to always say.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah. Yeah.
About, cause I always said, I remember this like 10, 15 years ago. Exercise, you know, do the exercise. And you're like, no, you have to do the diet.
Yeah,
you have to do the diet.
Yeah, that's why I brought up the
thing. You have to do both, of course. But
I think, I've come to your mode of thinking on that one because I've, you know, observed, because you and I now, I mean, we've always liked to be active, but we are in a living situation now where we're way more active than we ever used to be. Like we walk a lot, but on purpose. You know, we got the, you know, two animals over there. We just like to be outside. Right by the ocean, so it's just beautiful to be outside all the time, even in the winter when it's wet and dark and gray. But I think my perspective is totally different because how much we move our bodies now, we walk, you know, anywhere from 3 to, on a low day, we walk 3 miles. On a big day, we walk 10 plus miles, pretty much on a daily basis, right? So seeing that contrast, I think that if you did that as a human on a daily basis in America, you could get away with, you know, kind of whatever you want on the dietary side within reason. Of course you can't go crazy, but you would have a lot more leeway, so to speak, if you were just moved your body enough to offset whatever you're doing on the diet.
And you know, when you exercise, you do feel better. Everybody will say, oh, I'm so glad I exercised. I felt good. And then you're not, and it, you know, that psychology kind of plays with you a little bit. Like, hey, I exercised. I don't think I'm going to go, you know, I want to make some different choices dietary wise. You know, it all comes
You don't
together.
Think that it goes the other way, that if you've exercised, now you're going to reward yourself and you go that way?
I used to do that when I did hardcore cardio, when I do those cardio classes. It was like I remember talking to a gal. I did this cardio class way back, and we would laugh because I'd say, I'm going to go home and eat. And she goes, yeah, it's like an extracurricular activity. Because when you do those hardcore cardio, the cortisol goes up, you know, pulls all that glucose.
And you're telling your brain you want to eat carbohydrates.
Yeah, I'm hungry. So now that's why I do like to do walking, because that's really good for the adrenals. That helps bring down your glucose. That helps bring down your cortisol. I feel like it's good for your sanity. And then doing the weights, because when you do weights, your heart goes up super high. I mean, my heart rate will go through the, you know, through the roof when I'm doing squats. So I, even though they suck.
And nobody likes leg day.
But I do feel like, for at least for me, and, you know, maybe my age and other menopausal women, it's about trying to, the walking and the weights. Walking and weights, that's what.
Yeah. If you're, you know, and for someone listening that is trying to figure this out, just honestly, I would just suggest just start walking first, right? Mm-hmm. Don't even think about necessarily trying to become some kind of a gym rat and lifting weights if you're not accustomed to it. I think someone could completely transform their metabolic health by just walking. Now, I do think, though, that's what you and I've sort of, what I've observed about ourselves is that it does take a lot of miles. Mm-hmm. Like, you can't just walk for 30 minutes. Now, maybe if you did 30 minutes three times a day, that might be reasonable. But you have to walk, because we're a two-legged organism, right? We have to walk a long ways for that to start to have an impact. And of course, just like with any type of exercise, the more you walk, then the more you have to keep walking in order to keep that benefit going, you know, over time. But you know,
I know people say, "Oh, the time." You know, you're saying talking about the time, but now we have walking pads, which are really light. You can put underneath your bed.
What about stand desks, like e-bikes and stuff?
Oh, I love the my e-bike or my pedal assist, because there's a lot of hills here in Washington.
You're still moving, you're still getting out there. Yeah, that's what I'm saying, though. With an e-bike, you're not getting any of that exercise benefit.
Yeah, you still pedal with it. I mean, I know some are like
little mopeds,
still doing something. You're still breathing. You're still having a great time. It still feels really good to be outside. I think any of those are beneficial.
Walking versus an e-bike. Now, I'm not saying anything against e-bikes. E-bikes are fine. I just think that, you know, you're not going to get nearly walking.
Except for that scooter that you got.
Yeah.
Now, that looks dangerous, and that's not exercise.
That's what I'm saying. Neither really is an e-bike necessarily.
I think an e-bike can be exercise.
How?
Because you're pedaling. And you can use some, you can press it to help it assist you some more, and then you bring it down.
Yours is called a pedal assist or something.
Still the same thing.
I think there's other ones. I've never even been on an e-bike. I haven't even been on yours, but there's other e-bikes that just has like your dad's. His is just like a throttle that just goes.
Yeah.
what kind of exercise is he getting on his e-bike?
At least he's getting a little bit of pedaling rather than sitting on the couch.
I'm just being snarky, but.
You're just too old school. You got to have the regular bike.
Well, I have a bike, and I don't ride that thing either. But yeah, that's what I'm saying.
We have dogs.
Yeah, you and I just end up walking everywhere. But I will say, walking is kind of slow and boring. You know, it's really sort of slow and boring. But you sort of embrace it. You like it. You enjoy it. You find something good. But it's really great to. We walk in this trail here in Washington. We're right along the ocean, which is
just beautiful.
Nice to be able to see it every day. And so exercise. Diet, more protein, less refined carbohydrates, obviously.
Hormone replacement, if you're a good candidate, you know, hormone replacement, I think, can make a huge impact.
Yeah, in our wheelhouse, hormone replacement and GLP-1s, what kind of caveats would you put on the GLP-1s?
Oh, so like I was saying, the perimenopausal gal, she's just wants to fit into her pants. Maybe she's got about 10 or 12 pounds to lose. She wants to be really careful if she does those GLPs because she's just going to end up losing muscle mass because her appetite's down. You really have to work with a really good practitioner on doing very low dose, spreading out those injections quite a bit if you're going to do that. I would say, but it would be a good for even males too, you know, anybody that's looking at, you know, metabolic dysfunction, if they're a metabolic mess,
which is 90+%,
it could, you know, it could really turn their life around. You know, yeah. I've seen, especially with diabetes, I've seen people with reverse diabetes just being on these GLP-1 agonist injections. So I do think it's, there's no free lunch. It's not like, oh, I picked up my prescription, I'm going to, you know, give myself a shot and now I'm on my way. I really think you should work with your practitioner or somebody, or a nutritionist. Nutritionists are really good with that. So you can have kind of like your team. And I've always considered, you know, having your healthcare team so you can have success, because you don't want to be reliant on these GLP-1 agonist injections and then you go off of them and you gain the weight back.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So in some ways they're like a tool to help you develop different habits, you know, as you are making progress. Because that's why, like you said, you use a lower dose. I don't think they need to be for someone that's just trying to, you know, fit into their pants, right? They don't need to be using it every week. I think that's, and even at the recommended doses, too high of a dose, too frequently, now you're going to lose weight too rapidly and you're going to lose too much of it, and it's going to be impossible to keep it off. You know, if you did stop them at any point, that weight is just going to come roaring back at some point. Where if you did it, you know, spread out the injections from, you know, whatever period of time, lower the dose initially, just to give a little bit of a flip of that switch on the brain, so you don't have that, you know, that gravitation towards the processed food. Now, the appetite suppression, because you're not eating on a regular basis, that alone is going to, you know, sort of lower insulin, because you're just not consuming food that often. You know, I think that, you know, it can be a very valuable tool, but like I said, it just has to be sort of tailored in the right way for the individual. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So obviously we could talk about this one over and over and over. We won't beat the dead horse. Any final thoughts about that whole idea? You know, what's going on there?
Well, I will tell you, menopause, you're not alone. It's not your fault. It's the hormones that really kind of dictate. I always say willpower never wins, biology does. Yeah. So whatever we can do to offset, trick biology a little bit, create a new lifestyle. But I will say, for those women that are feeling frustrated, you're not alone.
Yeah. This one, if you have any comments, leave them down in the comment section below. We do look at all of them. If you have something you have on your mind, please leave us a comment. We would appreciate that. You mentioned a newsletter. There should be a link in the description as well. We do have a new newsletter that just came out at the beginning of April.
Yeah, we call it Progress Your Hormones. Progress Your Health, but Progress Your Hormones.
Yeah, it's a little play on words. And the main article, this one, is actually about the what we just sort of talked about. So we sort of let the cat out of the bag. But
that one will come out next week.
So this episode, will be out after that one is already released. So, but even still, we're really excited about the news. I know you've been enjoying writing it.
Very much.
Yeah. Excuse me. Until next time, I'm Dr. Mackey.
And I'm Dr. Valerie.
Take care. Bye-bye.